Welcome to SilvaCast, the podcast about all things silviculture. My name is Greg Edge.
And I'm Brad Hutnick.
And we are both silviculturists with Wisconsin DNR Division of Forestry and your hosts for today's show.
So, Greg,
yeah,
you've got a concerned look, belly up to the bar. You can tell me. you can share with, I'll be your therapist in here.
Oh, dear.
Feel free to share.
Okay. Well, okay. What I'm thinking about, Brad, is AI.
AI, like artificial intelligence?
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Do you know that now you can not only use a chatbot to get answers to whatever you want, but you can create your very own chatbot by putting specific manuals, guides, textbooks into it so it can be really good at answering questions. In fact, our colleague Teague, you know, is really into this.
Yeah. Yep.
He's probably at this very moment creating a virtual silviculturist. That's what I'm worried about.
I like that concept of a virtual silviculturist.
Yes. Picture yourself like Max Headroom. Somebody doesn't need to call you. They can just go online and see a virtual Brad bouncing back and forth and ask whatever question they want.
I guess. I mean, but come on, they're going to replace us? I mean, well, actually, they might replace us for lots of other reasons, but I don't know about on the technical side.
I don't know. I don't know, Brad. Don't be overconfident here. Just listen to this. I put the following example silviculture question in. This is just a standard chatbot, mind you, not a customized silviculture one. So I asked the question, what is an irregular shelter wood?
And that's kind of like that, what is the sound of one hand clapping, right? Because that's a complicated one, but I don't know. That's different.
Well, listen to the answer.
The irregular shelter wood system involves successive regeneration fellings with a long and indefinite regeneration period, resulting in a multi-age condition.
Whoa, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. And you know what? Okay, we should be worried. If that's how good it is, we should be worried.
I told you, Brad, it is pretty good. But fortunately for us, I've asked some more questions, and I think the technology is not quite perfected yet. So here, I asked another question. What is the proper target basal area for northern hardwood stands managed under single tree selection?
Ooh, I'm curious now.
Well, here it is.
Sorry, Brad, I do not use basal area.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's proof that Hal's an amateur.
So maybe for now, Brad, our jobs are safe.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Like you said, for this, right?
For this.
There's lots of other reasons that we should be worried, but for this, we're okay.
Yeah. There is lots of other sketchy things that maybe Carmen could get rid of us for.
That's right. Right. We're not going to go there. Keep it above the line.
Okay. Well, anyway, it's a good thing that there's better sources of silviculture information on northern hardwoods anyway. You know why that is? Because today on SilvaCast, we're going to be talking with Crystal Kern of the U.S. Forest Service's Northern Research Station about a recent study that I know got your attention, Brad.
Oh, the latest paper from the Argonne Experimental Forest's Long-Term Cutting Method Study.
That's the one.
Yeah, and there's some interesting stuff in there, and I don't think any chatbot is going to get that one right.
Well, we're fortunate today because we'll have the real thing, Crystal Kern, to talk it over with. Of course, I just can't help but get that picture out of my head of that virtual Brad bouncing back and forth. Instead of calling you, I can just turn on my phone and say, "Hey, Hutnick," and get an answer.
Always certain, often wrong. This season of SilvaCast is brought to you by the Nelson Paint Company, McCoy Construction and Forestry, and the Family Forest Carbon Program. You make the SilvaCast world go round, so thank you.
Crystal Kern, welcome back to SilvaCast.
Thank you.
Last time you were here, you were actually a guest host, I believe, Brad, is what Crystal was. And we talked about the Northern Hardwood Conference results.
That's correct. And this time it's a little less challenging having a host you're not aware of. So now we're well aware of Crystal coming in as a guest. So life is good.
Yeah, I don't know. You can still act like a host, Crystal. That's fine.
That's right.
Tell Brad what to do.
Yep.
It'll make my job easier. So, well, actually, before we begin, even though people may not have listened to the Northern Hardwood Conference episode and they don't necessarily know who you are, could you just tell us a little bit of who you are and what your job is?
Sure. Well, I'm Crystal Kern. I'm a research forester at the USDA Forest Service Northern Research Station in Rylander, Wisconsin. And I've been working as a scientist here for about 13 years. And prior to that, working for the forest since I was about 19 years old. Summer season positions and moving into a technician and so forth.
Yeah. And you've worked with us for a number of years now on all different kinds of projects. So we just really appreciate working with you whenever we can. And so it's great to have you on the show. And one thing that we do is ask a question sometimes of our guests about how did you get into forestry and forest research? What first interested you in this going way back?
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, as a kid, and I know a lot of your other guests say the same thing, is doing things with my family in the forest. We'd go up to the Nicolet National Forest for deer hunting, fishing, berry picking. My grandparents had a place there, water skiing, you know, enjoying the outdoors and the natural resources. And so I always had an interest in that. When I went to college and to further my education and I took silviculture and learned more about forestry, that just seemed like the right fit for me. And then I took a random, you know, volunteer internship here at the Rylander office when I was 19. And, you know, that was my first exposure to a real, you know, research organization. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of led, you know, one thing to another. And here I am today. So yeah, it's been a great experience and a fun career.
Cool.
Wow. Must be kind of interesting, kind of starting in Rylander as that volunteer. And now you're on the other end of that spectrum in Rylander.
Right. And I've been many places in between, working at, you know, three other different Forest Service offices in Minnesota and Washington, and done a lot of cool things. But yeah, coming back to Rylander, and I'm actually in the office of my first supervisor. So yeah, it's really come full circle.
That's really cool. So today we're going to be talking about some of the research that you've been doing and writing about recently. And so we probably need to, just for the sake of our audience who aren't all familiar with some of the stuff we'll be talking about, maybe going over some of those critical elements. And so one of those is the argon cutting method study. So could you give us a little background on that study?
Sure. So one thing in my position here that I just love is I work on long-term research studies like the cutting method study at the Argonne Experimental Forest. Trees can live 100, 200, 300 years, so our silviculture experiments can be just as long. So a lot of these experiments are multi-generations of scientists that have been studying the same treatments, silvicultural treatments, and how the trees respond to them. And so the argon cutting method study really goes back to the 1920s. That particular study goes back to the 1950s, but it was built on previous research going back to the 1920s that started in uncut forests in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And that original research working in, you know, what we would call old forests today, looked at sustained yield practices. A lot of interest in that time of not cutting over the landscape like we saw in a lot of the region in the early 1900s, and how could they sustainably take out some trees and leave some trees. You could go back at a regular interval and have saw logs coming out of those stands. So that early research was very influential, and that led to development of selection guides and so forth. And that work was published in the 1940s and the 1950s, and our landscape really had changed. At that time, our landscape was responding to that cutover from the European settlement. So the landscape was largely whole-size stands by that time. So there's still a lot of interest in sustained yield, taking some, leaving some, but the forests were not the same as what they were when this original research came out. So the Argonne was established in 1947 with the intention to understand how to manage our northern hardwood forests in that landscape that we now had of full-size stands, so young stands. And so the cutting method study was established in 1951 to look at both even age practices and uneven age practices. It was really unclear what to do with these. You know, prior to that, everything was focused on saw logs and, you know, a very narrow market. Now they were still very interested in saw logs and how to quickly as possible move stands to that. Yeah, so there was a lot of controversy, a lot of unknowns. So that study had, as a part of that, different selection cutting. So following up on that original work, and then also looking at thinnings and other even age practices. So over time, I think I'd be like the seventh scientist on that, that experiment. Lots and lots of different technicians over the years, you know, measuring these same plots over, you know, 60, 70 years. Yeah, so a lot of information has been coming out of that over the years. It's not something that started in 1951. And, you know, what I recently published isn't, you know, the first publication. There's been all sorts of work that's come out of that study over the decades. It's been really influential on our regional management. A lot of the work over the decades that's been published is still today referred to and referenced in current management guides like the Wisconsin DNR's Silvicultural Guide and other guides here in the US and in Canada. So it's one of the few spots in our northern hardwoods, if you think about that broadly from here over to Maine and into Canada, where we have, you know, just a few long-term studies like that. So the, all of those really serve an important role of providing long-term information about silvicultural treatments and how trees respond to them and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of the background.
So we're on year 70 then, right? With the cutting method study?
Yep.
Do you know, Crystal, how old those trees when they started them?
Yeah. So the area where the Argonne experimental forest is was cut over around 1905. And so at the start of the study, the stands were about 45 years old. So very young stands.
Okay. So just kind of get a time frame. Like you said, the importance of these long-term studies, we deal with these species that live a long time. And so you're looking at just over 100 years or so for those stands. So we still got a ways to go within them.
Yep.
Just interesting the importance of it is to look at these things long term.
Yeah.
Right. And another cool part of them is we know their management history exactly. You know, there isn't like, right, do we still have those files or it changed ownerships and you're not sure what happened. So we have a clear record of monitoring these stands over decades.
I'm always struck by like the value of these really long-term studies. And I always, to me, it's kind of interesting too, because the people who started that probably have no idea how we're using it now. So just because you start something for one reason doesn't mean it won't be valuable for lots of other reasons in the future.
Yeah, that's a great point. So the investment was put in, maybe today that's worth millions. It's something we probably couldn't put in today because we don't have the resources to do that. So yeah, having that foresight of putting in a well-structured study design and have all this information can be used for all sorts of different reasons. And other disciplines may be interested in, you know, the tree data that we have. And often we'll try to be creative, you know, not continue the original objectives of the study, but then creatively use that study. Maybe, you know, we recently shared that information with Ralph Nyland and his grad student, Sarita Basel. And we use data from their stands in New York to kind of have more of a comprehensive picture of looking at northern hardwood stands, not a specific point of the one study, but looking more broadly at trends and so forth. So it can be used in so many different ways. It's an incredible resource.
Yeah, cool.
The other thing that might be good just to review just for the discussion and maybe for listeners who don't work in our area or don't work in the system, but it might be good to talk about, you mentioned selection systems and single tree selection. It just maybe a broad overview of what single tree selection looks like, how it's defined in this situation.
Right. So in this, when the study was set up, what they were thinking about was entering into uneven age stance. So multiple age classes where you would be recruiting a new age class at a harvest, mid-aged size class, you'd be tending. And then your oldest age class, you'd be looking at harvest. So those high quality saw logs, and you'd be continually adding a new age class at each cutting cycle. So you'd have, you're doing a partial cut. So it's called single tree selection because you're individually making decisions on the trees. There's other versions of the selection system, but the versions that are at the Argonne are single tree selection.
So you have targets by diameter class for the trees in those situations.
Right, right. So yeah. Many small diameter trees, few large diameter trees, and you're trying to keep a regular growing stock in that stand with that structure, lots of little trees, lots of few big trees. As the trees grow, you can keep coming back and harvesting the large trees, thinning the mid-age trees, and recruiting the younger age class.
Yeah.
And it was really kind of going back to that earlier point of trying to develop a sustainable system where, right, where you could get a regular flow of product.
Right.
Out of these stands.
Yeah. So at the Argonne, it was an even age stand. So the idea there was that they really, you know, the profession and the group of people working at the study at the time were very excited about partial cuttings and selection system. And so the idea was that you can begin using selection like harvest in an even age stand to develop an uneven age stand over time. And today that might look a little bit what we might call improvement cutting. And the idea was after three of these that you could develop an uneven age stand. And so that was the thought going in. They knew they were even age stands, or mostly there were some wolf trees and whatnot left over. So there were probably a couple age classes, but it was largely in one age stand. And the idea was you could do these partial cuts and develop an uneven age stand that way.
Yeah, and that really helped inform what, well, we referred to as our even to uneven age conversion process. And we're not talking about conversion, like conversion to a different cover type or species, but conversion to, as you said, multi-aged or an uneven aged structure. And so that guidance that's been developed over these last 70 years has really informed a lot of that information that has gone into our silviculture guides, because obviously much of Wisconsin foresters are dealing with the same thing, these second growth northern hardwood stands.
So I think that sets the stage then. So with the Forest Service has been tracking development of that study or kind of just results of that study for a long time. So in 2021, you published a paper, Growth Yield and Financial Return Through 6 Decades of Various Management Approaches in a Second Growth Northern Hardwood Forest. And that was with, I'm probably going to butcher this name, Maeve Draper and Robert Froese.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually kind of tweaks some of the previous understandings of the studies, or at least our understanding of the results from previous things. And so maybe you could tell us a little bit about what some of those results are now.
Yeah. So our intention was to revisit some of the original objectives of the study. And so back in 1951, when this was established, it was about growth and yield. And a lot of the key papers that have come out of this study over the decades have been about growth and yield. So our goal was, we have a couple more decades of information. Let's revisit that and just see where we're at on our understanding from this particular study. And so we looked at things like growth, ingrowth, harvest, financial performance, and so forth. And I guess one of the interesting things that, you know, struck us when we looked at this was the performance of the 60 feet squared per acre residual basal area. So there are 3 selection treatments, and again, selection-like treatments that they were using to develop these stands. And one was called light and medium and heavy. And the terms were meant to suggest how much volume was coming out. So light volume, so a light harvest. So the residual basal area is 90 feet squared per acre, and then 75 feet squared per acre was medium selection, and then heavy selection was the 60. Based on the results at the Duke's Experimental Forest, which was where that original research was done in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, the idea was probably around the 75 something would be adequate for these full size stands. But they thought, you know, anything between 60 and 90 probably could work. So they, you know, had that range. They knew going really low to 50 and below would lead to tree quality issues. And with their focus on growth and yield in northern hardwoods in particular, very focused on high quality saw timber, that's a very, you know, big negative to have poor quality trees due to limbs and, you know, epicormic branching and other things that can occur when you get to very low basal areas. And then they also knew very high basal areas would mean slower growth, no recruitment, and so forth. So they were focused on this area where they expected, okay, performance between 60 and 90.
And so one of the changes, I think that, at least if I glean this right from the paper, one of those results was that the best balance of growth, yield, regeneration, and mortality was at the medium level. And now our understanding of that has changed.
Right. And I guess one thing that's important, that the previous results are all good, all valid, all important.
Right.
What showed up here in the more recent measurements is that medium selection, the 75, is still performing well. The 60 is catching up to it in several different metrics. Now, over time, the 60, the 90, and the 70, all three of the selection treatments have been tracking pretty similar. And a lot of things, it's just some of the trends were a little bit different. And I'm speaking as a scientist with statistical differences, what I'm talking about. So it was really in these later decades of applying these treatments, which I should mention were applied 7 times in the data that we have in that paper, 65 years of data with these selection light treatments, 7 times, like every 10 years coming in and doing the exact same thing. You know, in practice, you wouldn't maybe do that. You'd be evaluating the stands. For the research purposes, we just were artificially coming back in every time at those residual basal areas to see how these stands would react. And what the 60s has done well with financial performance in the past, which makes sense, right? You're taking out a lot of wood, had high growth rates. What's starting to change is that the ingrowth is really high. It's coming into merchantable sizes that we're seeing more in the 60 to develop that structure that we're aiming for in these stands. And the residual tree quality is also improving. So that's where, when we're thinking about the original objectives and growth and yield and this focus on high quality saw timber, that's, you know, with group at Michigan Tech that I was working with, that we, you know, really just saw the 60 at this point in time is really promoting and developing some of those aspects of uneven age stands more quickly, again, 65 years later.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In some of those aspects, like in growth, tree quality, and so forth. And it's not like it was, you know, any of them were bad or anything, but we've had a focus on the 75, you know, at least in recent times, on that being a really important residual base area.
Yeah, it's always been this balance between density and quality. And the focus before, as you said, Crystal, has been kind of sort of in that medium 75, I would go up to 80, that maintained the best quality. But what you're seeing or saying, in, at least in this study, is that that heavier treatment down to 60, that quality is also maintaining or improving.
Right. Suggesting there's some options. If there's other reasons that you're interested in a lower residual basal area, you know, there's some options, but that doesn't mean going to higher residual basal areas is bad. Again, it just depends on landowner objectives and what the goals are for those stands. And I would add that I think, you know, without doing any kind of like cutting down the trees and doing stem analysis and so forth, that the 60 has shown really high growth rate. The residual trees in that stand that have the survivor trees that have been, you know, thinned for decades have had, you know, a lot of release over time. being that this has been a young stand when they started, any corrections, probably for, you know, epicormic branching or lower branches, you know, things fill in quickly. Mm-hmm. And so those, and then the high growth, you can put on clear wood quickly. So that's why it may be just several decades before we're seeing that result in tree grade going up. And again, it's not statistically out of the ballpark compared to the other two, but it's really similar now to the 75.
Yeah. And to me, that speaks a little bit, I'm sorry, Greg, it speaks a little bit to, it's a little counterintuitive for the quality, because you might expect that higher densities would produce higher quality, or at least, you know, greater taller stems, things of that nature. This one's kind of flipping it. But like you mentioned, there are a host of reasons for that.
Right. And remember, this is over 65 years, maybe after one cut. Yes.
Right.
But if the stands have been treated the same way for many decades, it could be a different result. So in the 90, tree grade is starting to go down, and it's a high density stand, right? So after 65 years, and that used to be the one with the highest tree grade, but there's other issues, disease, insects, so forth going on in that stand because it is at a higher density and some of the quality is, it's still there. But it's, you know, that number is wavering a little bit because of the time in the stand and the solar power.
So, Crystal, what is the relative quality between the light, medium, and heavy? Is the heavy quality the highest currently, or is it statistically even?
Statistically, they're all similar, but the trend has changed, and that's been the same in the past as well. So, when people have been talking about this, it's about the trends we're seeing, and so that. The trend is just changing now.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, as you said, Brad, I don't know if it's counterintuitive. I would think that the heavy treatment, I would have said you would have gotten better in growth or, you know, as you said, Crystal, more release in those stands. But I would have expected maybe some more epicormic branching or retention of limbs longer. But maybe that is still... that even at that lower level, that's still enough density with those more vigorous younger trees, as you said, to kind of keep up with that and put on clear wood.
Right. And then you can also think too that over 65 years, their crowns have really developed, right? Of any of the survivor trees there. And the more dominant, codominant crown you have, the less likely you're going to put on epicormics at those releases because they've been released a bunch of times, right? So. Mm-hmm. And from that respect, they're going to respond different to a cutting at this point. Now, if you went into a stand today that hasn't been cut in 30 years and you take that down to 60, probably the crowns are small and it is going to respond with epicormic branching and, you know, some other things. So again, it's really important to remember context with the results of this study.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you next is what if you went into a stand that was older that didn't have that management? And then you had those small crowns.
Yeah, you'd have to do it kind of incremental. If you were shooting, if for some reason you wanted to have a stand bringing it down to the 60, you'd want to do that in, you know, increments.
Yeah. In a way, it makes sense too, because I think one of the things that you reported is that it was financially or economically, the 60 showed up best. And you didn't change the max diameter in that treatment. So it's really just the amount of larger growing stock that you're actually harvesting at any given point versus holding onto a longer point in the life of that stand. And that seems to me to make sense a little bit that you would expect if you were harvesting more of that stuff out of the, or not holding it as long, that would make more financial sense.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But you'd still have to have enough quality being produced that the subsequent harvests still had a good economic return. You saw that difference in the diameter limit treatment, right? Where they took basically all the value out right away.
Mm-hmm.
But then you didn't get that quality sustained over time.
Right, right. And with all three selection treatments, what's coming out is improving in quality. So what's being harvested, there's more quality wood coming out of those stands. And the residual stands are also improving in quality. So it's coming together over time.
Crystal, one of the aspects too that we want to consider is regeneration in growth into these stands. So did you note any differences between these treatments in terms of regeneration?
Right. So, and this fits with some of the work with Ralph Nyland and others, that it's, you know, some of these lower residual basal areas, the 60 to the 75, that end of it, we're seeing more regeneration coming in the last couple decades. So there's been, for several decades, and this has been noted in earlier publications coming out of this study, that there's been, you know, some understock size classes. When we're thinking about, again, that lot of many young trees, middle amount of mid-aged trees, and, you know, a few old trees, that right. there's been a gap in the middle. And so that we're finally seeing some ingrowth into those smaller diameter classes in the last couple decades. So I think that was another, you know, interesting point, in that just because you come in to a stand and do a harvest, a selection-like right. harvest, doesn't mean automatically there's a new age class coming in to that's especially in this situation with these pole size stands, it's going to take more than the three cutting cycles they're anticipating. And it, you know, maybe we're thinking 9 cutting cycles to get in multiple age classes into the merchantable size.
Is there any differences in terms of the species of regeneration between the treatments, or is it mostly sugar maple?
That is something we did not analyze in the most recent measurement. I'm going to guess sugar maple, but
yeah.
Is, you know, with our next steps with this data is to look at other objectives, such as more ecological objectives, diversity, habitat. There's other ways we can look at this data besides growth and yield. And so I think that, you know, that could turn up totally different, you know, aspects of this data and what these treatments can do or not do.
Right. And that really wasn't emphasis of the original study, is to try to develop, say, diverse regeneration. It was more that sustained yield over time.
Right. But I can share that the 60 is a place where they did notice, because of the low residual basal area and the natural gaps they had to create, that is the place where they noted things like yellow birch coming in and diversity mm-hmm. coming into that 60 selection. And so that led to observations by Gus Urban in the 80s, to the next scientist, Terry Strong, in the 90s, putting in canopy gap study, which is, you know, intentionally with this, like talking about the conversion process, using canopy gaps to establish a new age class with these selection like cuttings or improvement cuttings to make that conversion. So, you know, again, this study has been informing us all sorts of things in different directions over the decades.
Looking for continuing education credits? Check out the SilvaCast webpage for more information. And now, back to our show.
You mentioned Ralph Nyland, and we did interview with Ralph, and actually the title of the episode was The Green Wall, right, Brad?
Right.
So kind of referring to if you were actually getting multiple age classes in a stand, there would be enough regeneration of different ages and sizes that it would look like a green wall. You wouldn't be able to see through it. And I think about that too when I go look at the argon cutting method study. It's interesting to look at those different treatments in that just simple aspect.
Yeah, and I recall, Greg, the other thing that I don't know, maybe it comes into play here, but he talked about that kind of reversal of, if you had an even age versus uneven, then you had that reversal of the growth rates, so that maybe those larger trees are growing really well versus the younger trees aren't. And so there was another name, like an inverse kind of happening with that. I'm curious, you always look for those corrections. And one is that I was surprised that crop tree release does so poorly as a treatment. And so I think in the study you showed that it didn't produce high quality trees on a consistent yield basis. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I guess for that treatment, you know, for what we were looking at 65 years later, that perhaps the context for that treatment was more relevant to earlier decades. So continually thinning trees without a target rotation date. You know, that should be thought about with the research study. We've been kind of on a perpetual crop thinning timeline. And so right at this point, the value in the trees continues to stay in the stand on the property. And we're not seeing that in the harvest. So financially, that doesn't perform well because the value hasn't been harvested.
Yeah.
And again, at this point, we're seeing some defects and so forth starting on those crop trees that in a more practical setting, maybe those would have been harvested in an earlier decade, you know, when they're at their maximum value, if that was the objective of the landowner.
But if ultimately you got to a rotation within those and realized that value from that stand, maybe economically at least, that would improve its performance overall.
Right.
Although you're getting that financial return much later.
Right.
Than a sustained basis all the way along.
Right, right. And those trees are starting to grow slower compared to the selection treatments. So yeah, probably, you know, it would have been, again, if financial objectives were the goal, you know, maybe that decision would have been made sooner if that was, you know, the goal.
Crystal, I'm curious, and Brad, you're thinking, I'm going to let you think up there. Well, I asked this question. So I'm just trying to channel my field forester who might be doing, they might be doing the even to uneven age conversion process in northern hardwoods over the years. And maybe they're seeing some structure in the stand. So they're really then starting to do more true single tree selection and trying to manage towards that structure. And maybe they're using just the good old Arbogast distribution, which has been around for a long time with a 24-inch max diameter. And I think the Arbogast distribution, what Brad comes to be about 84 square feet of basal area is
right.
Sort of your target under the various size classes. So the forester is using that and looking or hearing about these findings, like, what does this mean? Should I get rid of Arbogast and just not do that anymore? Should I be looking at a different distribution and a much lower residual basal area? What does this mean for people doing that?
Right. Well, I'd ask, you know, what are the objectives? Are 24-inch trees a goal? Mm-hmm. Because most of our landscape, we don't have a majority of the stands usually that large. So it takes some time to develop that part of the structure.
Mm-hmm. I think some of it too, as you said earlier, Crystal, is really defining what those objectives and what those stand conditions are initially really kind of shapes what you might do, right? And that some of these findings just really lend credence to the fact that you have quite a bit of flexibility depending on what those objectives are and what those stand conditions are.
Right, right. Yeah, so that original work was developed in a very different landscape condition than we have today for the most part. So that can be applicable in some areas with more mature late successional forests that could be applied. Otherwise, it might be some time till you could directly apply something like that right now. But there are options of different structures. Residual basal areas is what we've been talking about, but we can talk about different structures that focus on more regeneration, getting in more growth, more focus on poles. You know, there's different ways to do things. And I think as a profession, we often get, I mean, there's just so much to do and so much responsible and so much good stuff we do, but it's because we have all these responsibilities, get focused in on certain tools and, you know, forgetting there's a lot more in the toolbox and just being creative and open-minded when you're going into stands and assessing what's there to see what is the best tool versus like always going back to the same one.
Right.
And truth be told, we have been maybe not as flexible as we could have been in the past, right? So we've been locked into Arbogast 24, kind of following a certain system, or maybe single tree selection is the way to do this. And I think what, you know, when I read this and I think about like our continual understanding, it's like you mentioned, really focusing on what are those objectives, but then not being, you know, totally linked to one particular way, but we do have a ton of flexibility in how we approach this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, this is kind of a important finding, and that's why Brad and I wanted to talk with you, Crystal, in a way, because here in Wisconsin, there's been a lot of debate about going as low as 60 square feet of basal area within a northern hardwood stand. It's like, we probably don't have enough to talk about that we argue about that. But as you said, Brad, we've in the past interpreted what's appropriate very narrowly. And maybe this shows that there's just more flexibility there, depending on what those objectives are and site conditions. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a statement in your paper too, there was something like, in some situations, maturity can be related to the economics, not necessarily in age. And that kind of makes, I mean, like with single tree or uneven age management, that makes sense. But sometimes you just need to see it in writing in order to kind of think about it again. So one thing I was surprised by, and maybe you could talk a little bit about it. So the diameter limit was not embraced, right? So we cut everything at 7 inches. You can kind of see how that's going to just fall apart over time. But it was at the very end, it was maybe like we shouldn't throw out the concept altogether.
Yeah, diameter limit is one of our tools. It's not a silvicultural system. The way it's been applied in the research study was intended to be kind of a mock system without any thoughts. You're just without any, you know, professional forester looking at the stand, just coming in every so often and just cutting everything 7 inches and larger. And not thinking about what you're leaving behind or any kind of objectives, it's just taking. But in certain situations, not the example at the Argonne, diameter limit cutting can be a tool. It's used as one of the tools in the selection system of a maximum DBH. You are considering that to be your, yep, your final rotation, basically at that individual level, and harvesting trees at a certain diameter. So in combination with other silvicultural tools, you can piece together a system.
That's kind of exciting in a way, right? Because one of the things that we've talked about with selection systems is just how intensive it is, right? And I think other authors or other researchers have noted that if you basically use that max diameter, like single tree selection, but then incorporated kind of the improvement practices, you know, kind of intermediate treatments along the way with that, that you can still get a lot of the benefits. Maybe that, you know, who knows about the regeneration and stuff, but at least it's like, hey, maybe there's opportunity to maybe get a lot of those benefits, but not necessarily have to pay all the cost.
Right, right.
Yeah. You'd still have to do that tending.
Correct.
Within those.
Correct.
Everything below your max diameter, whatever that is. I mean, to me, that's the core difference, right? Than just extraction, where you're just extracting every saw log above a certain limit. You're actually tending and trying to improve the stand.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the original goals, Crystal, of this study was to sort of create a sustainable system so that you would continually produce quality and economic return. So just kind of, can you just say of all the treatments, where does that stand? I don't know if there's like a sustainability bar or whatever. Is there a clear defining line between the different treatments, right? As whether or not you would consider them sustainable or not?
That's a good question. We didn't come up with a specific metric for that.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of all the selections, they're all doing, we looked at things like net growth. I guess that could be, you know, a sustainability metric. So are we harvesting more than growth and ingrowth in the stand? So you're digging into your residual crop. And all three selections aren't doing that. Something that the diameter limit has been unsustainable, has unsustainable indicators over time because it at times cut way more than what grew over the cutting cycle. So that would be unsustainable at that, you know, regular rate. But yeah, that would be, again, another interesting follow-up paper to look at sustainability metrics of the different treatments.
Yeah, I don't know if there's like one metric, right, that you could look at, but maybe a suite of metrics
right
around that.
Right. And it'll become like sustaining habitat or sustaining, you know, forests. Right. Are they still forests? Well, they're all still forests. So
I'm just picturing a sustainability bar, Greg, right. where, you know, like bellying up to the sustainability bar. You can use that title if you want.
Okay.
Yeah. Carbon sequestration. Yeah. There's all these different
That's right.
you could look at for sustainability.
Yep.
You know, the other thought I have too is, Does any of these results help us inform at all, maybe systems beyond just a very regulated selection-like or single tree selection system? So what I'm thinking of is we are looking at a lot of irregular systems within northern hardwoods right now. And sometimes those systems, we are cutting at quite variable densities within those stands. So can maybe some of those results from that heavy cutting or those lower densities help us, I don't know, determine where the bar is on maybe some irregular cutting, like if we want to try to keep quality in those stands, but we want, you know, maybe much more open space for regeneration, for example.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, that could be a modeling study where we, you know, take different treatments and then combine them in certain proportions of a stand and look at how that affects, you know, growth and yield at that stand level with different proportions and different residual basal areas. But yeah, I think these treatments were very defined and limited to a small space. And so, you know, trying to elevate what we've learned to different scales and in different patterns would be really, really useful. Next step.
Yeah, these were like very regimented treatments that you guys were very strict about.
Yeah.
But it just seems like this kind of concept of, yeah, you can still develop quality at some of these lower residual levels and develop maybe some more diverse regeneration. So you mentioned yellow birch, that maybe some of these concepts you might be able to flip those over into some of the irregular treatments that folks are doing as well.
Right. And maybe even in that situation, maybe in parts of the stand where you go down to 60, maybe it's not about tree quality. It is about the ingrowth and diversity and getting that part of the stand, you know, those elements. So yeah, I think we can just think, you know, it's not always about tree quality. There's all these other elements in developing uneven age stands and sustainable stands, depending on your objectives. Mm-hmm.
So Crystal, this has been really enlightening. This has been really interesting. Okay, we won't make you do a haiku for this, but if you wanted to encapsulate this, what's the most important thing you want foresters to take away from this update or this study?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to just remember we have options. We have multiple tools in our toolbox when we're managing our northern hardwoods. And to evaluate each stand for what it is, what its conditions are, and cross that with the objectives of that upcoming harvest that, you know, that they're in that stand reviewing it for. And, you know, that studies like this are rare but important and provide really interesting information that's been a cornerstone for our profession in the region. And we continue to have, you know, more information from that as time goes on. And it doesn't always mean there's, you know, major changes that we have to make, but sometimes in this case, just remind us we have, you know, we do have options.
Yeah. And for all those decision makers out there who have influence over budgets and projects and things like that, to me, I would like to emphasize what you said, Crystal, the importance of these long-term studies. We just can't create them again. We can't replace them, or at least you can't do it overnight, right? And so I really look forward to just continuing data coming out of these stands, and maybe we'll learn new things. Maybe the last results will be reinforced, but it's just a continuing snapshot, at least for that area and those stands, as to what these practices do, what their effects are. So
yeah,
I just look forward to just more results in the future.
Right. I can also add for a big take-home message is that There's 80 experimental forests across the U.S., and there's probably other experimental forests on university lands and state lands and other places. And when they have these long-term studies, they're incredible outdoor learning laboratories. So I know, Greg and Brad, you've both been to the Argonne many times in bringing in the folks that you train, that there's so much we can learn. And again, we can't, you know, in a week, just design stands that have been managed a certain way for 7 decades. You know, we can't go back in time and do that. So they continually to be a resource for learning and education and training. So if you're here in the Argonne area, you can contact me about visiting the Argonne Experimental Forest, but there's many across the country that you could reach out to your local experimental forest manager and get a tour. And I can guarantee you're going to learn a lot walking through those different treatments, because they are so different after decades and decades of treatment.
Well, Crystal, we really appreciate, as I said in the beginning, working with you, and just you're a really strong ambassador of these experimental forests and their importance. And it's just great to see continued data and information and guidance coming out of those. So thanks for sharing that with us. And there's probably more to come.
Awesome.
Yep. And Greg, we've got work to do to update based on new information. So this is fantastic.
Oh, so Crystal's making work for us is what you're saying.
That's the way it should be. I think we're supposed to be flexible to new information.
Oh,
that's what I heard.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yeah. That's what I heard too.
Yep.
So thanks, Crystal.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you guys.
Catch you later. All right. That, Brad, was a great conversation with Crystal.
That was. I like it when we dig into the detail, because we always need to come back to kind of like, there is a science. It's not just an art.
Yeah. So we did get into the silvicultural weeds, and that's good. So I'm happy about that. But for right now, Brad, let's play another round of Silvictionary.
Ooh. We're not going with Silvasaurus?
Oh, I thought it was riding the Silvasaurus.
I had to have you say that. I guess not. Let's just make it Silvictionary.
Our word for this month's Silvictionary is going to be free thinning.
Oh. Yeah, I really like that. There was that Tom Petty song, Free Thinning. It was... I thought it was a real up. It was good. I liked it.
You know, he's a silviculturist. Who knew?
We're all silviculturists, Greg.
Yeah. Well, you know, We all got that kind of cool Tom Petty look. So,
yeah. So free thinning is basically just do what you want, right?
Do whatever you want. No, it is not. Do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Just by the way, I have the SAF Dictionary of Forestry open, and the definition in this dictionary is...
Greg, you pulled that off the nightstand?
I got it right next to me. Yeah. All the time.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So free thinning, the removal of trees to control stand spacing and favor desired trees using a combination of thinning criteria without regard to crown position. So what does that mean to you, Brad?
So the way I interpret that is that in practice, we're going to be using several different techniques. So if we were in a stand and it was, we maybe had low thinning or thinning from below, and then we had crown thinning going on, we're going to really be responding to what's in that stand, but not necessarily being tied to only doing one of those things. So in certain stands, you know, if we're there may be, like, say stands haven't been entered in the past, then you might be forced to do lots of different things just by circumstance.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying stands that have a lot of variability in them, maybe they haven't been managed before, and you just need to respond to a lot of different conditions. And so you may be varying your techniques from low to high thinning, depending on the circumstances.
And to me, it's a little counterintuitive, because I think you actually, you need more skill to apply free thinning, because you have to recognize the need and then apply that particular part of what you're doing correctly. You know, it's easy if it's a thinning from below, you just go mark to a certain size or you look at other things. This one, you actually have to use what you know about the stand, what your goals and objectives are, and then try to turn what you're finding in that stand into what you actually want. So I love the idea. It's just that we really have to be careful about, it's not just a, like I mentioned, it's not just a, hey, do what you want because it's free thinning.
I'm sure there's probably a reference in the Tom Petty song that kind of applies to that, but I just, for the life of me, I can't think of it right now. So we're going to have to move on.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks for listening to today's episode of SilvaCast. If you have ideas for future episodes or a question for the Dropbox or heck, even a term for the Silvictionary, let us know.
Ride in the Silvasaurus.
Ride the Silvasaurus. You can reach us at UW Stevens Point's Wisconsin Forestry Center by emailing wfc@uwsp.edu. Feel free to include a sound file of your question or a comment if you like, and we'll get your voice on the air. We learn best when we wrestle with questions, so keep them coming.
And take care, everyone. And as always, thanks to our team, Susan Barrett, Editor-in-Chief, Joe Rogers, our IT master, theme music by Paul Frater, and of course, UW Stevens Point's Wisconsin Forestry Center.